Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how's it going?
It's good. It's good. How you doing, Dan?
It's all good, man.
You ready to Exodus?
I am. Dude, do you watch the show Better Call Saul?
No. I've been meaning to. I watch Breaking Bad, so I'm intrigued by Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul is great, but what I just did was a Better Call Saul-ism because, okay, spoilers. And also, if you don't care, because you don't care about either of these shows, sorry, this will just take a second. But Saul Goodman's name is not Saul Goodman. It's Jimmy McGill. He ends up changing it to Saul Goodman. And the way it comes about is he was a con artist, and he's conning this guy, and they do this thing, and he says to a guy, he's like, "What's your name?" And the guy said, "Saul Goodman." He's like, "Oh, Saul Goodman." He's like, "Yeah, Saul Goodman." So that's what I just did to you.
That's good.
Saul Goodman.
Saul Goodman. Yeah. I like it.
Yep.
I actually thought about watching that because I love Breaking Bad. So.
Oh, dude, you should. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. Yeah. Great. It's an incredible character show. You know, it's not Exodus though. Cause,
it's not Exodus. No. No, you can't beat Exodus. And I think in Exodus, we are ready to start a new chapter. I think we're ready to launch into chapter 17.
Right on, let's do it.
All right. So we're still not at the stopping point of our journey toward Sinai. We're close though, but we've got a couple more incidents that have to take place before we get there. And one of these, especially the first of these, is there's certain episodes in the Bible that always tend to come up. They resurface places. There's something, some quality about them that really resonates with people, or maybe something about them is so stamped on the nation's memory that they kind of become, you know, that thing that people refer to back to time and time again. Well, one of those is coming up in the first part of this chapter. It's it's what happens at a place called, it has two names, Massah and Meribah. We'll talk more about that, what those words mean, names mean in just a minute. But this particular episode comes up multiple times throughout the scriptures. And we'll look at a couple of those when we get into it. So that's the first seven verses, what happens at Massah and Meribah. And then the second half of the chapter is pretty interesting, too. It's got some kind of strange stuff in it that we don't see anywhere else. And that is the story of when the Amalekites attack the Israelites. And you have Moses going up on top of this hill, and he's holding up the staff, and he gets tired. And so Aaron is on one side, and a guy named Hur is holding up the hands of Moses, because when his hands go down, the Israelites start losing the battle. And when his hands are up, they're winning the battle. So that's the second half of the chapter. So we got a couple of different things to look at. We'll see how far we get.
You know what they always do, Chad, in the movies on this, they always incorporate that into the Red Sea thing.
Do they?
Yeah,
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
You mean like where his hands get tired and someone has to hold him up?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that.
Really?
Yeah, and multiple.
The two stories. Huh?
Yeah, and multiple depictions of this. There, like he's standing up on like some ridge or whatever, with his hands upheld and like in a motion like the parted sea.
Yeah.
And his arms are getting tired, and the walls of the are starting to collapse a little bit. You know, and it makes for a good visual, but. Just in case you guys are wondering, and if you watch those movies, and you're like, "Hey, wait a minute, like, yeah, that's not how that went down."
yeah, they're pulling together a couple of stories. Well, this is the only time that particular type of hands occurs. It's pretty interesting. I don't want to get too far ahead, but anyway, that's the second half of the chapter. So first half, we have thirsty people, complaining people, wants more, and that they keep getting more and more agitated as time goes on. So we'll see what happens here. So it just says basically at the beginning of the chapter that they continued on their journey. All the congregation of the Israelites journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to God's command. And they camped at a place called Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. And you don't even have to read any farther to realize what's really about to go down. Because as soon as we hear there was no water for the people to drink, you know there's going to be complaining and threatening and wanting to return to Egypt and why are you doing this to us, all that kind of stuff. And that's exactly what transpires afterward. So there's no water. We've encountered a situation before but it was so bitter that the people couldn't drink it. That was at that place called Marah back in chapter 15. And there we have the tree or the branch thrown into the water so that it made it drinkable. But here, bitter water or a little water, you don't have any water. And so, verse 2, therefore the people quarrel with Moses. Now, we've upped the ante here because a different Hebrew verb is used here for the people's confrontation with Moses. In the past, they grumbled against Moses. So they complain. You know, they I guess we could say they bellyached to Moses the first time around. But the verb that's used here, reeve, is almost a like a courtroom. Kind of, in fact, it is used in the prophets very often that the Lord has a case against his people, a reeve, like a suit against his people, almost a legal dispute. So the verb that's used here is even more more serious than what we see before. More than just belly aching. This is threatening that's going on here. They quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses says to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Now, right away, you can't see this now, but you will see it as the story goes on. The particular words that are used here for quarreling and for testing, that becomes the basis of how this particular place is named. It's going to have the name Massah and Meribah, derived from the verb meaning to test, Massah. And Meribah is derived from this word for quarreling. So Massah and Meribah, testing and quarreling. But already here at the beginning, we see these two words used. So the people quarrel with Moses. They say, "Give us some water. Hey, why are you reaving with me? Why are you quarreling with me? And why do you Massah? Why do you test the Lord?" And then he goes on. The people thirsted there for water. They grumbled against Moses and said, and we've heard this before too, "Why have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So what does Moses do? Moses cries out to the Lord and says, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." This is getting a lot more serious than what we've seen before. So in the past, the people complained. They said, "Yeah, why did you bring us out of the land of Egypt?" But this complaining has escalated to kind of a legal case. And kind of in conjunction with that, Moses is actually afraid for his life. So that's the first time this has happened. They haven't actually threatened Moses, or at least some sort of a life-threatening situation. So Moses is really, he thinks his life is on the line here. And so he cries out to God to do something to save him. And we'll finish the story up and then go back and talk about a few things here. So here's what God says to Moses. He says to go in front of the people and to take some of the elders of the people of Israel. They're going to serve as the witnesses. And to take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Well, that's a significant detail, which we will come back to that in a minute too. But the Nile, and it's not just take the staff, rather, not just the staff, but the one that you hit the Nile with, that staff. And then God says, look, I'm going to stand before you, Horeb. So God's on top of the rock, and you shall strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And so Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And we're not told, but water came out of the rock. And then it finishes off this this little section in verse 7 by saying he named the place Massah and Meribah, plural, of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not?
We've all been there, Chad. I've been there on the
side. You want to relay a personal story about people trying to kill you because they were thirsty?
I've been at my house on a Sunday afternoon, gone to the fridge, no beer, can't buy it because it's Sunday, fallen to my knees, cried out, how long, oh Lord? We've all been there.
Yeah. The suffering and the deprivation that we endure is pretty horrible.
It is pretty wild, man, that they're like, all right, Moses, think about like the logic here. Just, like, sinners are dumb, man. Like, unless you were wondering, in case you guys don't know, sinners are stupid. And they're like, all right, here we are. We're in a desolate place. There's no water. We're all going to die if we don't get water. Moses, you better freaking find some water or we're going to kill you. And you're like, yeah, kill the one guy that like has been coming through. Like, that's probably going to work. That's probably a great idea. Let's kill him. Yeah. I mean, he's going to die if he doesn't get water. It's not like he doesn't have motivation to find water.
Yeah, it's not like Moses, you know, he's carrying a big 5-gallon canteen. He's good to go. Yeah, he's going to die too. And you're right, he's the only one who has done good for the people throughout this whole ordeal. So he goes back to Egypt, even though he doesn't have to. He brings them out of Egypt. He saved their life in the Red Sea. He sweetened the waters at Marah. He gave them manna to eat. I mean, he's done nothing but good for Israel. But it goes to show, I think, a couple of things. First of all, the lack of logic among sinners, oftentimes they're reacting emotionally. They're reacting just viscerally. They're not acting. They're not logically whatsoever. They're just saying whatever comes to mind or giving vent to their anger, which is usually a very illogical thing. And then simply the lack of gratitude. I mean, we see this over and over in our own lives as well. I mean, we can have all these wonderful things happen to us. Something bad happens to us. It's like all we can think about is the bad thing that happened to us. And we forget completely about all these good things that happened to us before. I mean, you can go 5 years where everything is fantastic and then have this 1 week from hell. And it's like you forget about all those years of good that just transpired. And all you can think about is the current suffering. So, I mean, sinners are notoriously have notoriously short memories. We don't think long term about all the good things that God has done for us. We tend to fixate on whatever bad thing happens to be occurring in our lives at the moment.
I know this. These are the kind of passages that let you know that going into ministry is like a great idea. And you read this and you're like, like I bet you leading God's people is like the best.
Yeah, you've probably seen a meme on Facebook or social media where picture this old guy, he's like in his 70s, and he says something like, I don't know why people say the ministry is so hard. I'm 42 and I feel great.
Moses, you know, Moses is probably thinking like, yeah, be the deliverer, they said. It'll be fun, they said. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah. Now they're trying to kill me. Yeah, it's like there's no matter what happens, they're always, I mean, this is just the beginning too. I mean, we got 40 years more of this. that's going to happen. In fact, so this is at the beginning. You may recall that later on, and I think it's in the book of Numbers, almost the same situation occurs. The people are thirsty again. They're threatening again. There's a rock. God tells Moses to take his staff and to speak at the rock, and water will come out of it. Remember this story? Well, Moses loses his cool. I mean, he's finally had it. And so instead of speaking to the rock, he whacks that rock as hard as he can with the staff. And water comes out, but it's that particular episode which then prohibits him from entering into the promised land. He's no longer scared for his life. He's just mad. He's frustrated. He's lost patience with the people. And so he does what God didn't command him to do. He dishonors God, and because of that, he's not able to enter into the promised land.
I feel like if
So
that were.
that's later on in the wilderness stories. But it goes to show you how all of this kind of builds up over time in the life of Moses.
I feel like that would have been like somebody's head long
Yeah,
before,
I would have been.
long
I
much
would have hit
earlier.
like hitting heads instead of the rock.
Be like.
I wouldn't have the patience to be Moses, especially the older I get. I think the less patience I have, especially with situations where people are quarreling, and I have absolutely nothing to do with the situation, or no way to resolve it.
And well, Moses is an old man too, after all.
Yeah, he is. He's 80 plus at this point.
God'd be like, "Hey, speak this words to the people." I'd be like, "Oh, I got some words for these people. I'll gladly speak to them.
Yeah, I've got a few things to say.
I got some things on my mind." Yeah, that's probably how that would go down.
So,
I mean, like, it is one of the things too. I mean, like, it is one of the things that you read in the Bible, and like, it'll be cool when you get there because there is reasons for it that are theological, but practically speaking. You are like, hold up, man. Like, so these people, like, Moses is not going to get in for this.
oh yeah, that's always seemed like monumentally unfair
Yes.
from my perspective. I mean, he put up with these people for 40 years and he messes up one time, and yet he can't get into the promised land.
And there's, and again, there's theological reasons for it. I won't spoil it. And they're good. They're really good.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
even when you give the theological reasons for it, you're still like, bummer for Moses, man. That's
Yeah. He gets on the mountaintop. God shows him all the land that he can't go to.
not cool, God.
And then he's dead, and God buries him, and nobody knows where his grave is to this day. But, Moses can't get us into the promised land. The law can't get us into the promised land, right?
Those are the theological implications. The law can't enter there.
That's it. Law can't enter there. The law dies outside the promised land. It's only Joshua, Yehoshua, which is of course, the Hebrew name for Jesus. He is the one who leads us into the promised land.
Of course. All right, now we're doing it. Now we're bunny trailing. I'm just gonna
Well,
say
yeah,
it now. Okay,
we had to go full theology there.
now I'm going there because, like, I know this. There's something about the law not being able to enter the promised land and buried in like where he can't find it, and we got to spend a bunch of time trying to find it so we can bring the bones of the law into the promised land. And we've been doing that ever since.
Yeah, that's the quest of sinful humanity, right?
Yeah,
We got
where's
to
the?
find the bones of Moses. They're our only hope.
Oh, yeah, we gotta find the. Like, you know what? If we could just find the bones of the law, bring them into the promised land, we'd really have this working. It's what
Yeah,
we try to do, like, all the
like
time.
the symbol of the Galatian heresy. The Galatians were always trying to go back under the law. It's like a shovel, walking around, digging here and there, trying to find those bones of Moses.
Yeah.
They're our only hope.
the church the church is still actively doing this, like, both actually. Like our in archaeology, but also just, theologically speaking, we are like trying to find the remnants of the law to be to bring in and make a relic out of it. Like, this would really be helpful. It'd be really helpful.
I'll give you a great example of this. So last night, I'm reading through the latest issue of Christianity Today. And on the cover, they have a, I'm looking at it now, they've got a picture of a donut with pink frosting and little colorful sprinkles on it. And these words are all across the front: "For I do not do the good I want to do, But the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing.
A little Romans 7.
From Romans, that's a quote from Romans chapter 7. And so I'm excited because I think, oh, cool, they're going to deal with, like, the fact that we're simul iussi et peccator, we're simultaneously saints and sinners, talk about the old man and new man, the struggle, all that kind of stuff, because, that's what Romans 7 is about. So I read the article, and I read the entirety of the article. And the article is basically this. It's by quoting that verse from Romans 7 and talking about how, that's a struggle that Christians face. And then for the next four pages, proceeds to describe how, if Christians are serious and engaged in their spiritual life, they're able to discipline themselves so as to increase their levels of self-control and be able to resist sin and do good. So
Awesome.
the whole article basically disputes the verse from Romans 7 that it starts out quoting. Because Paul says, I can't do the good I want to do, and the evil I don't want to do, that's what I do. And this article goes on to say, well, actually you can. If you work hard enough at it, you will be able to maintain enough
If
self-control
you
to
find
good,
if you
to
find
do the
a
good you want to do.
if you find a couple of ribs of Moses, you can definitely get it done.
Yeah, that's all we need. It's a placing people back under the law without actually saying so, making it appear as if, well, if you just, if you really are a seriously committed Christian, you'll be able to do this. And they always add, with the help of God. But that's all they're doing, is really putting the law back on people, saying it is your responsibility to do this so that this will result. So you won't sin. Be serious in your discipline as a Christian, and you won't do
Yeah,
evil.
how the application is how to avoid a Romans 7 experience.
That's exactly it. Yeah. How to avoid a Romans 7 experience.
Yeah,
So it's a, I mean, this is it a
which Paul seems to think is unavoidable.
major Christian publication. So if you're looking for examples of how we are still trying to find the bones of Moses, well, there you go.
The most offensive part of that article is actually that sprinkled donuts are actually gospel and not law, for sure. That's just
I thought it was an insult to the world of donuts in general to.
that's just a theological fact. Sprinkled donuts, that's gospel.
That's like the post-church sacrament in a lot of churches. You gotta have donuts after church, right?
We got donuts at the church. We had donut holes. That's gospel,
Problem
baby.
with donut holes is you think, well, I'll just, they're so small, I can have several of them. And you end up eating more donut holes than you would have actually if you'd eaten just a donut.
It's true, but donuts, manna, same difference.
Yeah.
That's what we refer to it at our as our church. We'll say what we get up to say there's coffee and manna in the back if you'd like some.
There you go. Donuts from heaven. Well, how do we get to talk about all that? We get off track a little bit. Let's go back and talk about one thing about this particular episode, which I think is worth discussing, and that is, how do you test God? Accuse the people of doing. It says, why do you, this is back to verse 2, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? And I came up with a, I think is a, and I'm borrowing this, stealing this from a commentator, which I think did a pretty good job of it. He talks about this verse and in relationship to other verses too. See what you think, Dan. He describes this as what it means to test God. This is a summary of what he says. To test God is to seek a way in which God can be coerced to act or show himself. Like to force God's hand or to make belief contingent upon a divine demonstration. And I thought this was good. This is his line. He says that to test the Lord is to try and turn faith into sight. I thought that was a pretty good summary of what it means to test God. So here the people are, and they're testing God by saying basically, listen, if you are really God, I mean, if you're this good and gracious and merciful God who has redeemed us from slavery in Egypt and brought us to this point, then prove it. Believe it. We need to have We need to see water if we're going to believe that you are, in fact, our Redeemer. With some kind of visible proof that our eyes can see before we're going to accept that, in fact, you are our God. So it's turning faith into sight. It's trying to coerce or force God into doing something for us so that we will believe in him instead of seeing what he's already done multiple times for us. I mean, it's not as if God had not already shown them that he was good and gracious and wanted nothing but the best for them. I mean, he brought him out of slavery. He brought him through the Red Sea. He fed him with manna. He sweetened the waters at Marah. So it's not as if they don't have anything to look back on where you see a demonstration of God's mercy toward them. All of that disappears. They demand something else. So that is testing God. I don't. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that that's exactly right, because when I think of testing God, I think of the language of the New Testament, where you had the temptation of Christ. But what most translations will say, and there in the Greek, you have this: Jesus was driven out by the Spirit to be tested. So if you want to know about the testing of God, well, you have a specific example of God in the flesh being tested by the devil. And the testing is this: if you are God, do this. If you're truly the Son of God, do this other thing. Mm-hmm. And it is, and it, like, I mean, even things like turn stones into bread, right? Hey, throw yourself right off this, you know, this temple, and you know that sort of thing. So I think that's very much that is in good biblical company to say, yeah, testing God is demanding that God do something to prove that he is God. When he doesn't have to do that, he is God. And so, and you also then know that testing God is like very much the devil's move. I mean, mm-hmm. he's the one you ultimately see doing it with Christ. So when we test God, we are doing that out of, let's say that that's an old Adam move for mm-hmm. sure. Because it's certainly the move the devil makes.
I'm glad you brought up those temptations. That actually, great minds think alike. I guess that's actually where I was going to go with it too. That it fits perfectly actually with everything you were just describing. So I mentioned earlier that Massah and Meribah, this whole incident, comes up multiple times in the scriptures. Here is one of them. And listen to this, and then put it in connection with everything that Dan was just talking about. So this is from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16. And the first part is what Jesus quotes back to the devil. It starts out, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." And then the verse ends with these words, "as you tested him at Massah." So you shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. So this verse from Deuteronomy is referring back to the section in Exodus that we're talking about, that particular testing. And then that is the verse that Jesus quotes to the devil when he's on the pinnacle of the temple and the devil says, "Hey, if you are the Son of God, then throw yourself down." So you put all that together. And what Jesus is saying is, I'm not going to in some way push God to give some divine demonstration of saving me from a situation that I never should have been in to begin with, because that would be testing God, just like the Israelites tested God at Massah and Meribah.
Yeah, I think that you see that faith doesn't make demands. Faith requests things of its father, right? So Jesus addresses this specifically and says that there is a generation that seeks a sign or demands a sign. And what he says about that is that it's evil and adulterous. That's how he interprets, you demand a sign? Well, demanding a sign from God, so demanding it, saying that this is what we must have, that's evil. That's testing God. Now requesting something from God, that's different. We've been given, even commanded to bring our needs to God and request that he take care of us. But requesting something from your father is very different from demanding something from your father. I don't know if you have a father, but you probably know how this goes. I know, like, growing up, those two things worked out differently.
That's the best way not to get what you want.
I know he knew the difference between me, like, asking for something and me demanding something.
Yeah. Yeah, the surest way not to get what you want is to demand it from your father. The exact opposite.
And, like, it's weird, too, because, like, the response is sort of the same, just with a different connotation. If I go and I ask something of my father, the response is, "I'm your father." If I go and demand,
I'll be happy to give you that.
And if I go demand something from him, he's like, "I'm your father."
Mm-hmm. Same words, different tone of voice.
Different tone of voice. Like, don't come here and demand stuff of me. That's how it goes.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the amazing things about this particular story is that God doesn't. God kind of leaves it to Moses to speak a word of warning and condemnation to the Israelites. God doesn't, you know, chastise them for what they've done. Moses does. Later, certainly God will. But at this point, God is keeping his silence. He's letting Moses do the talking for him concerning the testing. So he's still being very gracious and merciful and long-suffering with the Israelites. Now, that will come to an end, because there will come a time when God... lessening, and he has to discipline his children. But at this point, he's still providing for their needs, even though they are testing him.
Yeah, it's like Moses knows that that's coming, because he's very much like, "Hey, pump the brakes."
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same. Everyone needs to slow their roll, because this might end bad.
Yeah, you're.
Like, you just, we should really stop pushing here.
Yeah, you're getting a little too close to the fire there, Israel. If you can see, I mean, this is kind of supposed to be the honeymoon period. Later, Hosea, I believe it is, talks about this is like the days of youth for Israel as the bride of Yahweh. So this is kind of like, this is supposed to be the honeymoon period, you know, where everything is great, no quarrels, everybody's happy. This is like getting on a fight on your wedding night. This is not staying up all night, sleeping on opposite sides of the bed. This is not a good omen for what is to come. Very, very, very brief honeymoon period for Israel. But anyway, that's what happens at Massa and Meribah. And as one author put it, he said that Israel, it's sin on the map. I always like that expression. They literally did. So this place was called Massa and Meribah. So their particular sin of quarreling and testing was put on the map so that it would be remembered by subsequent generations as to what happened here. But God did provide. Water comes out of the rock. They drink. Everything is good.
Dude, you have to think too. I mean, like, think about this. So Moses goes and hits this rock with, like, the same stick that he had, like, hit the Nile with and all that kind of stuff. But, like, dude, like, you're talking about a lot of water. Like, I think
a lot of thirsty people there.
Dude, there's a lot of people, man. And, like, so I think you think about it, like, you hit the rock, and then, like, you know, it starts, like, a little stream comes out, and everyone kind of gets a handful or whatever. Like, no, man. Like, this is, like, gotta be. When I read Exodus, and, like, there's events that happen like this, I'm always like, now, how long did this take? Like, all right, everyone get in a line. Like, this is, like, taking days. You know, to get all these people water. This is all, like, a ton of water that's coming out of this rock to, like, give all these people. I mean, I don't know what the exact number is. I mean, we can only estimate, but it's a lot of people.
A lot of thirsty people. I was trying to find this phrase. There's a somewhere in the Psalms. It depicts the water from the rock as almost like ocean waves coming out. So this is. This is the idea of, like, I always picture a fire hose.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you hit the rock and, oh, look, yeah, I see that little trickle of water coming out there. Well, this is like you hit the rock and boom, opens up so that there's plenty of water for the people. Like streams in the wilderness. come out of this, so the people have and you got people, you got livestock, you got a lot of thirsty mouths.
And it's weird too. I mean, this is something that you wouldn't think if the New Testament didn't like make this really clear. But even this rock is a type of Christ. You have this like all drink the same spiritual drink kind of thing, like, and that rock, like from the rock, and that rock is Christ, right?
Yeah. There's a Jewish tradition that's reflected in Paul's words there. It's 1 Corinthians 10. And he says, right, I believe that's the language that's used there, and the rock's fallen, and that rock was Christ. There's a Jewish tradition that there was this rock that actually like rolled along with the Israelites, and that became the source of water for them. And so Paul is reflecting some of that when he says the rock that followed them. But yeah, I mean, he calls the rock Christ because from which we drink the waters of salvation, just like they drank from the rock here in the wilderness. Example, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a great example of the extent to which the apostles find Christ everywhere in the Old Testament. Hey, there's a rock that water comes out of here in Exodus 17. That's got to be Jesus.
Yeah, no, it comforts me for all like the stretches I feel like I'm making, because that's like one I probably wouldn't make. You know, right. if they didn't make that jump, I probably wouldn't do that one on my own. You know, I'd be like, yeah, there's rock and there's water coming out. I probably wouldn't be like, so much, that's so totally Jesus. But Paul does it, so you know it's okay. And so, you know, hey.
Yeah, it's comforting to me when people sometimes accuse me of stretching things. I don't know if I see Jesus in that or not. I'd be like, well, you know what? Jesus in that rock that water came out of, but Paul did. So I think it's we have apostolic example of this, the extent to which we are finding Christ all over the place in the Old Testament. So yeah, that rock, that was Jesus. Water came out of it. Salvation came out of Christ for us to drink.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? That's it, guys. That's what we got through today. And hey, if you guys want to do something amazing in October, you should probably come hang out with me and Chad in San Diego. It's going to be a massive event, big, huge party, celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. It will be October 19th through the 21st. You can go over to herewestillstand.org and check out all the details. The rate's low. You're gonna get like fed, and you're gonna hang out, and you do not want to miss it. You gotta sell what you gotta sell to get there, so you can come hang out, because you will. I don't want you to like see photos and videos and be like, man,
should have been there.
Most regrettable thing of my life was not figuring it out. So yeah, herewestillstand.org. Go check it out, and we would love to hang out with you for 3 days in San Diego for sure. Chad, thanks, bud. Have a good one.